History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Following the German occupation of France in 1940, French women moved into jobs and roles left by their male compatriots, even the role of soldiers. One of the most notable in France is Lieutenant Sonia Vagliano. She was part of a team of young French women attached to a U.S. First Army unit that arrived in Normandy 2 weeks after D-Day. From 1943 to 1945, Vagliano followed her unit from Normandy to Paris, through Belgium, and finally into Germany, where they cared for 41,000 total displaced persons and prisoners of war. Vagliano recorded her experiences in her memoirs, and she talked about caring for thousands of refugees in the worst possible conditions. She did many other things, including defusing landmines and being kidnapped, shot at, torpedoed, and bombed, but also recounted the major events of the war in Europe, including the liberation of Paris, the Battle of the Bulge, and finally, the liberation of the concentration camps. Spending 5 weeks at Buchenwald, repatriating the 21,000 remaining prisoners, she was a unique witness to the transition period between the camp's liberation and its transferal to Russian oversight in July 1945. She saw firsthand, quote, to what extremes the human imagination can go in its search for the most cruel methods of torture. Today, I'm speaking with Martha Newell Evans. She's a professor and translator of the book into English. Vagliano's memoirs have been well known in France since the 1980s, but Evans brought the book to the attention of English-speaking readers for the first time. This is a fascinating exploration of World War II through the eyes of someone whose stories typically don't make it into the main historical narratives. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Martha Newell Evans. Martha, thank you for joining us and talking about your book. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here.
First of all, before we get into the life of Sofia Vagliano, what brought the French language memoir to your attention and why did you decide that it was worthy of translation?
A very good friend, Sarah Vagliano, was the sister-in-law of the author. And we were talking about the Vagliano family, and Sarah told me about a cousin who had signed on for the French resistance during the Second World War and had actually been caught, tortured, and executed, which was, in fact, very impressive. And then she said, oh, and there's another member of the family who was in the war. And she handed me the book that Sonia Vagliano had first written and published in French in 1982, and it had actually gotten a prize for the best memoir of the year. So she handed me the book, I read it, and I was blown away. I thought it was brilliant, amazing, interesting. And I was a French professor and translator at the time, and I said to Sarah, has this been translated into English? And she said, no. So that's how the project began. We were off and running on that.
Well, we're going to get deep into the particulars of Sonia's life, but I suppose we could, first of all, speak more broadly about what's happening in France in the early stages of World War II and the response of French women. So broadly speaking, how did French women respond to the German occupation in 1940? And what sort of new social and occupational roles did they move into?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Many of them continued with their lives. They were under siege. They were occupied. They kept their heads down, just concentrated on getting food for their families and going on with their daily life. Many of them, like Sonia, well, first of all, in just a couple of months after the occupation of Paris in June of 1940, the students got together. She was 18 years old at the time and scheduled a major demonstration against the Germans, which was wildly courageous. They wore yellow stars, and Sonia actually got arrested at that time, taken to the German police headquarters and told she had to report once a week. So she was involved in resistance to the Germans and the occupation very early. Many women, especially very young women, volunteered for the resistance And they could get away with their activities because nobody paid attention to them. You know, they were these kids riding around on their bicycles, but they actually carried messages to and fro for the resistance. So that's, I think, basically, that's how women reacted, either not so much by contributing to the war effort, but either by just carrying on and maintaining their daily lives or by volunteering directly for the resistance.
Right. As a nation under occupation, it's very different than other nations that are openly mobilizing for war. So activities are taking place or more clandestine. And other information about Sonia, getting into her background, what are other parts of her story that you think are relevant to this discussion?
What's interesting is her family was actually a Greek shipping and banking family that went to Italy. That's when they changed their name to Vagliano from Baglianos. Then they went to Marseille and then finally to Paris. They were very wealthy. She lived an upper class life in a big house in the 16th arrondissement, which is the chic section of Paris, paintings, furniture, et cetera, et cetera. Her father was a French citizen. Her mother was American. And her mother had volunteered as an ambulance driver during the First World War and was actually decorated personally by Marshal Pétain. So, and her father then joined the resistance and did activities for them, including hiding Jews in their house. So the family, even though they were wealthy and looked like they should be very conservative politically, were actively quite liberal and were participating in the resistance against the Germans. So her mother encouraged her to participate in these activities. Anyway, I mention this because her upper class status, I think, influenced a lot her activities while she was in the French army and gave her she wasn't stuck up or snooty about it, but I think she just had a sense of some entitlement. And so when there was a problem, she'd go to the top instead of very often going through the chain of command. She got into trouble for that. I can talk about that later. But I think her social standing was a help to her in accomplishing some of the things she accomplished during the war.
You describe from the first episode you mentioned as a student protesting the German occupation until she makes contact with the U.S. Army. Could you describe her activities during this period?
Yeah, well, what happened, her father became very worried because of the necessity of her reporting to the German police. Plus, here was his wife, who was an American citizen, and he was convinced that the Americans were going to be in the war very soon. So in January of 1941, they decided that the mother and Sonia should go to the United States to get out of harm's way. So they were able to do that. They arrived in New York, and Sonia tried to enroll in the Free French Army at that point and told she was too young. She was very frustrated, but then she enrolled in Smith College. And so she attended Smith College for 2 years and was graduated from Smith. But while she was there, this shows her determination and her almost obsession with getting into the Free French Army. While she was there, she learned how to fly a plane, which was very unusual for a Smith College student. And she studied auto mechanics, among other things. She graduated with a political science degree. Anyway, then she went back to New York. She still couldn't get into the Free French Army. It was complicated. And so what she did, this is a very good example of her not observing the rules, which was another characteristic of hers. She slipped orders for her into a pile of papers to be signed by the Free French Army guy that she was actually volunteering for in his office. He signed it, and so she had her orders. So she was on her way. She left New York in August of 43 in a big convoy going to London. It took them 3 weeks to cross the Atlantic Ocean, And a third of their convoy was destroyed by German torpedoes, but she made it to England, where de Gaulle's Free French Army was based at that time.
How did she imagine she would be involved with the Free French Army?
Well, that's interesting you ask that, because actually she wanted to be a spy. So they were just starting the women's units of the French Army. They had never had women in the military in France before. And so she talked to her commanding officer and said, look, I want to be a spy. And the woman said, I think you're a little too young for that. Let's just go ahead with the training and then we'll see. But it was interesting because just a few weeks after she was there, they instituted a new unit, which was a liaison formed to provide support for the liaison for the Allied forces when they invaded Europe. And actually, it's interesting, the Allies have been planning for months, obviously, for this move into Europe. And they realized that they were going to need liaison officers with the local government authorities. And so they started the Civil Affairs Unit. Eventually, it's interesting, the Monument Men became a part of that Civil Affairs Unit. Anyway, they trained these officers. And so they needed language speakers and people familiar with the local government and so forth. So the French liaison unit was going to be attached to these American civil affairs units. They were called the G5. So she went through regular military training with the English women's military, then got into what was one of the few women, as she was a half dozen women out of about 60 men, who got into this liaison unit and went through extensive training with them, including special training for the women, which was interesting. I have one thing from that time that I just made me laugh. When she arrived at the English base for the training of the women military, they gave them their uniforms and clothes, of course. And she said, not only did they give us our uniforms, they gave us army underwear. And part of this underwear for women was a lace-up corset that they were supposed to wear under their uniforms. And she was, I think that was one of the rules that she probably broke early on. I don't think she wore her corset. But it's interesting, all through her army service, in the most dire circumstances, these young women were wearing skirts and stockings, you know, which is amazing to me. Anyway, that's how she got into the French army.
I'm curious, with her admittance into the French liaison unit, there was a place for women to be involved, and perhaps she saw herself before this time period as a spy, because that's clearly a place that women were given positions for. Allied intelligence figured that Germans might overlook French women, so they used this to their advantage to gather as much intelligence as possible. And of course, I mean, units are not integrated by gender at this time period. So if there were a place for women, there would be a particular reason for it. Why was there a space for women carved out in the liaison unit where other units, for example, there wouldn't be such a space carved out?
Well, that's interesting, because early on for this particular part of the French G5, they decided not only would their job be liaison with local authorities, and of course there was a big argument about the role of de Gaulle and all of that, but they also decided that they were going to set up refugee camps, because they realized that the local population were going very often to be displaced from their homes, and they were very worried about their movements, about choking up, getting in the way of the military, choking up roads, and so forth and so on. So Sonia was going to, very early on, was identified, and they were going to form teams to take care of that. So she was identified very early on as a potential member of one of these teams in refugee camps. Well, the other thing that's interesting, women got a very particular training for this, and they learned how first aid, they learned how to feed lots of people, they learned how to build ovens outside, they learned how to first aid. She even camped out for a week with the Girl Guides. to have an experience of, I don't know, outside living. Anyway, so they got actually a very special training, different from the men's training. And actually, what's interesting is that many of the men who were in this American military, not the French, but the American military people who were in the G5, felt it was a kind of come down for them. And they, some of them were not happy to be taken out of the battle units to take care of refugees. So it was very interesting. They, eventually, a couple of them became very dedicated to their jobs. But at the outset, a couple of the commanders were not happy to be where they were at all and kind of left things to the women and to set things up and take care of things.
I want to get into the particulars of her descriptions of the major events that she witnesses during the war. But first of all, in general, the G5, could you describe from their first encounter with refugees to how they process them, how they provide care for them? What did that process look like? And what were specific things that Sonia did in this process?
Well, her first assignment, actually, it was interesting because this is the Normandy invasion after D-Day on, I think it was June 6th. Eisenhower said that women were not going to be sent into Normandy for another 3 months. Well, 3 weeks after D-Day, Sonia and her team and about 40 other women from this liaison unit were ordered to Normandy. So their job was to set up what they called transit camps. They were right behind the front lines, and they were to gather people in here, keep them off the roads, and then as soon as possible, return them, either return them to their houses or send them back farther to camps that were farther away from the front lines. So that was her job. And so they, when they took them in, one of the things that they did, first of all, was dust them with DDT. They were afraid of typhus in the camps. And in fact, in many camps, that was a major problem. But the other interesting thing is she and her team were tasked always with cleaning up the facilities where they were going to house the refugees. And in this particular unit, they always used existing buildings. They did not set up tents or they weren't outside. So they were using existing buildings. And in all cases, they were buildings that had been just abandoned by the Germans, usually a day or two ahead of the time when the French arrived. So she and her team met with horrible circumstances, having to clean out, very often leaving human excrement around. So that was their first job. Then they had to process the incoming people. They made a list of their names, where they were from. They took care of the DDT, and then they had to assign them to particular housing or barracks. And then they had to set up feeding them. And in the first place in Bayeux, where they were, they had to build an outside oven, make sure they got food supplies, set up an infirmary. It was a huge job. And they very often, and this was true throughout the entire war, they worked very hard and they usually got very little sleep and were tired all the time. They were exhausted because they were working so hard.
Where did she move once she arrives in Normandy? Are her activities primarily in France? Is she assisting in other nations as well?
Well, what happened, she stayed in northern France. It was very interesting. She was in Normandy. You know, it took the Allies almost 3 months to clear out Normandy. So she was there for that entire time. And one thing, when I was just rereading the book, I realized that she was really instrumental in saving the town of Saint-Lô, which was a notorious Allied bombing incident during this Cobra breakout campaign. They just destroyed the city. There was only about 10,000 people there, but it was a historic city and it was just totally destroyed. So interestingly, the Allies were talking about not repairing it. They were talking about removing the population who was left and just leaving it as a ruin, as a monument to the destructiveness of war. And Sonia was assigned to go to Saint-Lô and tell the people, look, tomorrow we're coming to get you. You have to go live in this refugee camp. We're going to take care of you. Well, she got there and there weren't that many people there, but they came out into the central square and she's talking to them. And then this woman comes out and says, look, I'm the leader here and we're not leaving. And Sonia says, you have to leave. These are the orders. She said, no, if we leave, this town will never be rebuilt. So she was very persuasive. And Sonia said, okay, look, I'll do what I can do. So she left. And instead of reporting this to her immediate commanding officer, she went to the general headquarters and talked to the big chief and said, look, you've got to do something here. He said, Missy, he called her Missy instead of Lieutenant Vagliano, which I thought was interesting. He said, Missy, you've got to observe the chain of command. You can't do this. She said, look, if I do that, nothing will ever happen. And she's discouraged, so she turns to leave, and he says, wait a minute, I'm coming with you. So he went to Sando, and he talked to this woman, and he was persuaded too. And so he went back, and he said, look, you were right to come talk to me, but never, ever do this again. But her intervention saved the city. They allowed the population to stay there, and the city was rebuilt. So she stayed in northern France. When Paris was liberated, she was there the day after the liberation. She was there for the big parade of De Gaulle down the Champs-Élysées. She met up with her family, of course. And then the big question was, are they going to allow these French liaison units to follow their American unit? She was attached to a First Army unit. Are they going to allow them to leave France and go, you know, follow them for the rest of the campaigns? And there was a huge argument about that. Nobody quite knew what to do with them. And Sonia and her commanding officer in this unit, who was a Rothschild, went around and talked to all the officers and generals and ministers they could, and finally got permission for them to follow their unit outside of France. So the next place she went was a very large place in Belgium, in Verviers, which ended up being between the lines during the Battle of the Bulge. And that was one of her major experiences of war while she was there.
Before we get to that, and that's worth dwelling on, this is an aside, but it sounds like part of what makes her so effective is she knows how to blur the lines between following orders and I don't want to call it insubordination, but she knows how to work around the chain of command, find those gray areas, have frank conversations with superiors, and her class status and other things like that. It sounds like it gave her a confidence to conduct herself in that way. Now, there's a fine line between someone who's headstrong and plucky and willing to work pragmatically to get things done. And then if you push too far, of course, you could risk defying orders, open insubordination, and in the heat of wartime could very well get you court-martialed or even executed. So how do you think she navigated that so well in that gray area?
One thing I found out very recently, I didn't realize that she was a tiny little thing. She was 5'2". She was thin. She was this little thing. So I think her physical presence was not threatening to people, but she had a very large willpower, and she was very smart and very persuasive and tenacious. She didn't give up on things, but she occasionally did get into trouble. One time by some complicated set of circumstances, but she had to house her team in a brothel one night, and word got out about this, and rumor was that the Americans had sent some French girls to help out the American army. And when her commanding officer, the one who called her Missy, found out about this, of course, he blew his top and was just about to kick her out. But again, she convinced him it was the only option. They had come to town late at night. There was nowhere else to stay. Her team couldn't sleep in the truck. So they had free beds at this brothel. What else was she supposed to do, et cetera, et cetera. One time, though, she did go AWOL and was about to get into big trouble for that. But here's the typical solution to this. She was at a army base where she wasn't supposed to be, and the commander invited her to a party, and there she met General Bradley, whom she had already met in London and kind of knew. And so they were talking, and she explained to her. And so he gave her a pass to circulate in all of the territory that he was commander of. So it kept her officially from, you know, being AWOL. So that's how she she managed always to get out of these scrapes, and she never stepped over the line. And she was so helpful and so efficient and so bright that I think people realized and were in the end kind of grateful to her for getting things done.
You can question her methods, but you can't question her results. Maybe that's how some looked at her.
Exactly. Yeah.
Returning, you mentioned the Battle of the Bulge. Can you describe what her experiences were there? Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Oh, wow. Well, they were in a camp in Velvier. I think there were about 3,000 people there, and they were right in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge. It was in, you know, December, January 1944, 45. It was super freezing. It was below zero. And she says they were, you know, out of food, they were out of fuel, they were out of electricity. They were having a very hard time of it. In fact, the artillery was hitting not too far outside of their camp. People were afraid they were coming in from the local town. And things got so bad that the American Army G5 was ordered out of Velvier. And so Captain Ball, who was commanding the camp at that time, said, no, I can't leave. And they said, look, this is an official order. You have to leave. So here they are leaving. They have this camp with 3,000 or 4,000 people in it. And guess who he leaves in charge while he's gone? Sonia Vagliano. She's like 22 years old. And here she is in charge of this camp. So she was very, again, very inventive about trying to find food for the people who were there. And it was so cold that there were cattle that were frozen, lying dead, frozen in the fields. And so they managed to get some trucks going, and they went out and they picked up the frozen cattle and brought it back and made soup out of them. And so she was able to feed the people. After about 3 or 4 days, I believe the Americans came back, but back just in time for Velvier actually to be hit directly by bombs. It was on December 27th. They recovered, and then, of course, in January, the battle was over. The Allies had won, and so they returned to normal. And in fact, they had such a model camp that the Army was sending other units in to observe how they organized things and so forth. So that was her experience in the Battle of the Bulge.
Then the liberation of Paris, what is her experience there?
That was interesting. Of course, she was super happy to find her father and her older sister who had stayed in Paris during the war. And she said something that was interesting that I don't know the facts about, but she said there weren't that many American troops there in the city, which I thought was interesting. But anyway, of course, everybody was deliriously happy. They're celebrating. De Gaulle had his big march down the Champs-Élysées. And it lasted for about 2 or 3 days, she says. And then after that, a kind of hangover took over. And the kind of resentments and enmities that had been festering during the war started to come out. And actually, it was a very scary time for France, because not so much in Paris, but in some other parts of northern France, the people were attacking the collaborators. Women who had slept with Germans had their heads shaved, were paraded naked through towns. They actually assassinated some people. And De Gaulle was able to, and this was one of the reasons that Sonia admired him so much, and so many people admired him, he stepped in and was able to impose some order on the country. But she said it was interesting to see the mood sour over just a period of 3 or 4 days.
As she moves through France, as it's liberated, her being French, what do you notice about how she's describing this, and personally, as France is, as you mentioned, going through its hangover and beginning in the very early stages to process its wartime experience? What do you note from her descriptions?
She concentrated, I have to say, mostly on her personal experiences. And she did not discuss or look very broadly at what was happening in France. So I don't know how to answer that question. She did not comment a whole lot on that. She was very intent on solving the problems of her units being able to leave France. And actually, one thing, she was very, very frustrated by the bureaucracy of the French military and the French who were now going to be a temporary government. And she found that absolutely outrageous and that they were totally out of touch with, well, not totally, but very much out of touch with the military difficulties of what was going on in the war.
As they move into Germany, this is where Allied forces begin to encounter concentration camps and liberate them. What is that like for Sonia? How does she describe it? How is she involved in the liberation? And what is that like for her?
Oh, my golly. Well, when they got to Germany, people felt that this was in February, March in 1945. And people felt that the war was winding down. The Allies were triumphant. And so a lot of prisoners of war and slave labor that the Germans had were using in Germany were escaped or liberated. And so there were thousands of people circulating in the first place that she went to in Germany. They had had 5,000 people in Belgium. Now they had 20 or 25,000 people in their camp. It was just this huge. Anyway, she and her commanding officer were very efficient and organizing all this, doing very well. And she was going to stay there when suddenly she got orders to go to Weimar. She arrives, and again, Major Lewis, who was the one who called her Missy, was there. He was a Protestant clergyman, she said, and he was having a drink. And he said, "This is the first drink I've had in 30 years. And she says, "What's going on?" He said, "I have just come back from Buchenwald." This was in April. I think she was there like April 12th or 13th. The camp had been liberated by Patton's Third Army on April 11th. And it was, of course, everybody was shocked and appalled and couldn't believe what they were seeing. And it's interesting because Edward R. Murrow and Margaret Bourke White went into Buchenwald just a couple of days after it was liberated. They were the first people to report, journalists to report and take pictures and so forth of what was going on there. Anyway, Major Lewis says, "I have an assignment for you, but you do not have to accept this. And this is to go to Buchenwald with your teams, and you will be in charge of repatriating the prisoners who are still there." And she said, "Well, how many? A few thousand?" He said, "No, there are 20,000. So she said, "No, if you want me to do it, I will go." So she was the first American or woman army officer to enter Buchenwald. She was there about 10 days after it was liberated. And in the interim, there had been a Third Army guy who was in charge of it. Actually, it was interesting because he had worked in a prison in Indiana. And so he was kind of used to dealing with this kind of situation, although it was so radical, nobody could believe it. Anyway, so she arrives, her Captain Ball sets up. They have an army hospital and so forth. Anyway, there they are with these 20,000 people in just horrible situations. They have to sort out the living and the dead in the barracks. And she said, just the dead bodies, they would just pile outside of the front door for them to be buried. Anyway, they got organized. One thing that I think is interesting, I have to say, so many people have written about the concentration camps, and especially also about Buchenwald. It wasn't an extermination camp, it was a work camp. And at its maximum, they had something like 80,000 people there. When she came, they had already shipped a lot out, they had done death marches and so forth. And so there were only 20,000 people left when she got there. And about half of them were Western prisoners. The rest, they had a lot of Russians, a lot of Poles, Ukrainians, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, one thing that's particularly interesting, former internees there have written about their experiences. A lot of people have written about the liberation of the camp, but I wasn't able to find any cogent, detailed accounts of the interim period between the time when it was liberated and the time about 3 or 4 months later in July when it was turned over to the Russians because it was going to be in the Russian zone. And so her account of this, to my mind, is particularly valuable and interesting.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. That's a very important point. What sticks out to you about her description during this 4 month period?
Well, one thing that sticks out to me was that the everyday running of the camp. I think this is, I mean, everybody knows this, but it was very interesting to me, was turned over by the SS to a group of German communists who were internees there. And actually, they had been there for quite a long time. And so they were very efficient at running the camp. And the SS said, fine, let them do the work. So this committee of German communists essentially was helping to run the camp. And they were the ones who made work assignments and so forth and so on. And so it was interesting to me that these men at the opposite ends of the political spectrum, the Nazis on the one hand and the communists on the other hand, somehow formed this partnership in running this concentration camp. And like the Nazis, the German communists were very efficient and very competent at organizing. So that was one thing that absolutely fascinated me. The second thing was that she tells about, as she is touring the camp, there's all these facilities that one didn't, you know, assume were there, like a movie theater, a rec center with ping pong tables and so forth, a canteen where you could buy foie gras and caviar. There was an infirmary and, as she said, an impeccably kept hospital. There was a stables and horse ring. There was a little zoo with a garden. And there was a brothel that had been set up. Now, in principle, the prisoners had access to all these. Of course, only a few were able to really profit from them, but still the fact that it was this huge thing. The other thing that I thought was particularly interesting in her account, and again, I have read, I looked and looked and could not find any other evidence of this. People talk about the children who were there. There were probably around 800 children there, including Bruno Bettelheim and Elie Wiesel that everybody knows about. And they were taken care of. But after Sonia got there, one of the officers says, look, I have something to show you. And he said, maybe you can help us with this. He takes her, there's a big shed, and inside are about 40 or 50 young boys, naked, crawling around like animals on the floor. There's straw on the floor. He said, they're afraid of men. We can't do anything with them. Maybe you can. And they threw food into them once a day. And that was it. They stayed locked up in the shed. And so she and her team go in and eventually, you know, the children become not afraid of them. And they are able to move them into, you know, a barracks. But they didn't know even how to walk. They didn't know how to talk. They didn't know what a name was. They didn't know they had names. And so these women had to start from scratch, just trying to bring these children into the real world. At the beginning, they slept on the floor under their beds. They had no idea what a bed was. And the first time they went outside, they were, of course, awestruck by seeing the sun and the trees and all of that. So that, to me, I call them the wild children. That, to me, was a very important part of her narrative. Another thing that was interesting to me was not only the fact her big job of repatriating the prisoners, but also she was involved in, they had lots and lots and lots of visitors. At first, Patton required the Third Army people to come and see. He said, you need to know what you're fighting for. So they had thousands of Third Army people coming through. Then they had a patent also required the inhabitants of Weimar, which was just about 4 or 5 miles away from the camp, to come through the camp to let them, to make them see what the, you know, had been going on their doorstep. And it was so appalling to them, of course, that the mayor of Weimar and his wife committed suicide the night after their visit to the camp. But then VIP visitors started coming, senators, congresspeople. I mean, it was insane. And so they had to arrange these visits. And part of it was showing them, this is where, I don't know if you are aware of this, this is where they had the lampshades made out of human skin. And they had not only lampshades, but they made ladies' handbags, shoes. This was all the instigation of Ilse Koch, who had been the wife of a former superintendent of the camp. And so they had, they showed them, Sonia called it the horror show. And so it was very upsetting to them to have to organize these visits. And they actually suspected one of the senators of stealing a couple of the lampshades. And it got so bad that after a couple of months, General Bradley absolutely stopped the visits and said, no more. We need you to concentrate on what you're doing. So that's what had happened. So the army supplied them with airplanes, and she was very successful in repatriating all of the Western prisoners. Many of the Russians and Poles were left in the camp when she left in June, and the camp was turned over to the Russians in July, on the 4th of July, actually, and they turned it into a kind of internment camp. And the interesting thing is that the death rate under the Russians was worse than the death rate under the Nazis.
Yeah, that'd be disheartening to work so hard for months and then see that turned over to people that don't have a humanitarian care in the same way that you do. What happens after the transfer of Buchenwald to Russians for Sonia, I'm speaking of, in her memoir and then beyond her memoir for the rest of her life?
Well, what's interesting, she was by this time, and she's just like 22, barely 23 years old. She was made head of the entire, all the teams in the American zone. And I don't know how many people that involved, but she was given a big office, 2 secretaries, a driver, etc. So it was obviously a very big job. One of her jobs, and this is extremely interesting, was by this, the American Army had left, and she was now under the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Agency, and they were taking care of repatriating the Eastern Europeans. And of course, people had found out what happened to the Russians when they got home. And the many who were prisoners of war were executed as deserters, and others, many others were sent to Siberia to the Gulag, and they didn't want to go back, obviously. But so she had the very horrible job of organizing the turnover of these Russians to the Russians to be sent back home. And she said her last 3 months in Germany were just the saddest and most disappointing and difficult time of her whole war experience, to see just how ghastly and cruel this end was. And the American, before they left, the American army officers that she was friends were just, instead of celebrating VE Day, they were disappointed and unhappy because at the decisions that had been made at Yalta and the decision to basically turn over Eastern Europe to the Russians. And they said, well, the military has won the war, but the civilians have lost the peace. And it turns out they were right about what was going to happen. As far as Sonia is concerned, just a couple of months before she left Germany, she met a young French doctor who was also there doing a somewhat similar job to hers. They went back, she got discharged on October 1st, 1945. They went go back to Paris, and in November, they got married. And so she was married by in November 1945. He was quite well off, and they lived a very comfortable upper bourgeois life in Paris. and she had two children. And the interesting thing is, very similar to many, many other people who have lived through wars, and especially people who saw the concentration camps, she never talked about her experience to her family or friends. And finally, when she was in her mid or late 50s, she decided, for I think a variety of reasons, to write about this. And so her daughter, whom I have been in touch with, and it was very helpful in preparing this book, said she thought she wanted her children to understand what had happened to her. And she also, Sonia herself, said she just felt it was her duty to let people know, you know, what had happened. So she, this is interesting, she first wrote the book in English. She had this dream of getting it published in the United States and of having a movie made of it, which I think is a fabulous idea. Anybody in Hollywood listening? Anyway, she wrote it partially. She didn't write the whole thing, sent it around to, I think, 25 publishers. They all said no. And this is a measure of her tenacity. She came home and wrote the whole thing in French. Got it published in 1982. And as I said, it won a prize. She was also decorated. She got the Bronze Star from the Americans. She got the Croix de Guerre from the French, and was also made a member of the Légion d'honneur. And her only real connection that she continued for the rest of her life, she worked for the De Gaulle Institute in Paris, and she remained a huge admirer of him. And I asked her daughter, I said, why was she so, you know, gaga over De Gaulle? And she said, well, he saved France. So that seemed like a very good explanation. Anyway, that was it. And they had a very nice apartment in Paris. She had a house in Normandy, where she died when she was 80 years old. Unfortunately, she was already gone by the time I got involved in this project, so I can never talk to her directly. But I was in touch with her daughter. It's very interesting, and there have actually been books written about this, that even after participating in these non-traditional and very trying circumstances in the military during the war, and they actually did institute a permanent women's military after the Second World War in France, most of these women went back and lived very traditional lives. And it did not start a big women's liberation movement in France, the fact that these women had done all these absolutely amazing and non-traditional things. They came back and slipped back into their old lives the same way that Sonia did.
Well, with this project, what do you hope that readers take away from her account of World War II, offering a perspective that from somebody whose voice is not part of maybe the larger historical narrative, but also somebody who saw things that hasn't been reported on extensively by historians? What do you hope that readers take away from learning about her World War II experiences?
Well, I think I've been thinking about this lately because of the current events in Ukraine and talking about 2 million refugees leaving the country. And I think it's very important for people to read about the inside experiences of, I mean, the people who were inside the activity of taking care of refugees and displaced persons, and that they understand how difficult and complicated it is, and how devoted the people have to be, and how messy and frustrating it can be sometimes. And it's not romanticized. She doesn't romanticize this, and I think that's very important. She talks about struggles between refugees often, and who were even sometimes attacking each other. There was such enmity among them. And so I think it's extremely important for people to understand this story from the inside, and not the official story, but what it was really like for people who took care of refugees and organized them during the Second World War.
Well, I wholeheartedly agree that there are many historical events that have contemporary relevance, and you've pointed out one of the many ways that this story has contemporary relevance today. And for listeners who want to get into this story in considerably more detail, the name of your book is Lieutenant Sonia Vagliano, A Memoir of the World War II Refugee Crisis. Martha, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, God. I totally enjoyed talking with you.
All right, that is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to parthenonpodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.